Flint, Michigan. How many people do y'all know from Flint, Michigan? Hey, in this episode of Why Not You, I had the honor and privilege to speak with Mr. Cloyce Dickerson, who is a native and a Detroit Lion fan. Anyways, I can't wait to dig into this episode. He is the Area Vice President of Digital Health, and he co-hosts Intentionally Yours Marriage Enrichment Group with his wife, Sheila. Such a blessing. Hey, anyways, without further ado, let's get into it. This is your host, D. Wells. Why not you? Here we go. Here we go. Welcome to another episode of Why Not You. I'm here with my boy, Cloyce Dickerson, in the house. How you doing, man?
Doing good, man. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for joining.
Good to be on the show.
Good. Hey, before we get started, man, I just want to kick it off with a quote of the day. Since the topic of today is intentionality, the quote is, people are anxious to improve their circumstances, but are unwilling to improve themselves, therefore remain bound.
Wow, that's pretty good. Right. So where'd you get that quote from?
That is from James Allen, As a Man Thinketh. James Allen, As a Man Thinketh. So a little quick bio on Cloyce, man. He's with Baxter Healthcare, and he serves as a digital health area vice president. And he's the chair of Baxter Black Alliance Employee Resource Group, which has 1,200 members. So that's just his career. Now his profession is his family.
His brother's profession is his wife, his marriage, and his kids being a father.
Yeah, it took a long time to get to that point, D. I'm finally here, though.
That's right. So, man, so this the topic that we got, man, intentionality, it's I think it plays a big part of like who we are today and could definitely dictate where we go in life if we don't have it. And I know that you grew up in Flint, Michigan. Share your story with the people and how you grew up and where you grew up and how intentionality kind of played a big part of your life.
Well, you know, I'm basically close to 60 years old, but in terms of being intentional, I'm probably about 10 years old, man. It took me a long time to get to this point. I'm still trying to figure out who and what I want to be in life. You know, people often will take a look at you and think, okay, this individual has it all together, but they don't see the transition that you've gone through in life. And, you know, growing up in Flint, it was a rough upbringing, but it taught me some very valuable life lessons and really how to move in this world. You talk about Flint, it's a city that's about 70% Black in terms of demographics. And, you know, transitioned from Flint and went to a pretty much all white college in Olivet, and which it was about 98% white and 2% Black. So, you know, it was a very valuable life lesson for me and really taught me how to move in this world, whether it be just in general or in corporate America. And, you know, you've got to be able to be a chameleon in this world if you're going to be successful and assimilate with the general population. So my upbringing was very valuable for me.
So you just when you talked about college and the ratio from Black to white, how was it in high school? Was it the same?
High school? Well, it was pretty much the other way around. Freshman and sophomore year, I ended up going to Central High School. Central High School was probably 60%, 70% Black, African-American, and, 30, 40% white. My junior year, I transferred to another high school. I actually left home at about 16 and ended up living with my grandparents. And as a result of the government buying their property, they ended up in a pretty much exclusive white area. And that high school was, 80-20. So it was, that was an adjustment as well. And it kind of prepared me for my experience at Olivet.
Got it.
And opened my eyes to a lot of other things that, you know, other than my culture.
So one thing I did not know is that you end up bouncing at the age of 16.
What was that about?
Oh man, it was a transition, D, and a lot of people don't know that story. I was a young kid that was really battling my identity. My dad's name is Clois, and I was a junior. He was a hell of a basketball player. I had a tremendous reputation, and I struggled to really live up to that name. And wanted to do everything I could to run away from it. You know, started doing drugs at, man, probably 12 years old.
Wow.
Getting into trouble, you know, hanging with the wrong people, doing the wrong things. And, you know, all because I didn't want to live up to that name and was really afraid to live up to it. You know, the bar was set pretty high right from the beginning. And once I really accepted the challenge of living up to it, my life began to change, along with, you know, some other people in my life that really helped me along the way.
Yeah.
So it was a rough transition until about 16.
Now, do you think it was internal pressure or was it pressure from the outside to that that made you feel like you didn't live up to the name?
There was both. Certainly, you know, there was the expectation when they heard the name Clois that I would be exactly as my dad was. My dad, you know, never drank, never smoked. I think I may have heard my father curse maybe 10 times in my entire life. That's 60 years now, almost 60 years. So it was difficult to live up to that. And I'm not so sure if it was more internal pressure that I put on myself, more than, you know, other people putting pressure on me. So it took me a while to accept that responsibility.
As you talk, it just made me think of my childhood also, just not so much the pressure feeling like I needed to live up either my mom's or dad's expectations, but that transition part where you talked about the demographics, the ratio with Blacks, whites, and it made me think about when I was living with my mom after my parents split. You know, when I was 7, the school that I was at was predominantly Black and Mexican. Mom's, you know, she was getting tired of her brother, you know, messing up his school, right? She kind of gave me that ultimatum. You're going to go live with Pops if you don't take care of business. So when I go live with Pops, even though I took care of business, I end up moving back to Mountain View, which is where we originally were. And when I went there, it was like a culture shock because the school that I was at was predominantly white. And there were actually 8 Blacks in my graduating class. So that right there was a culture shock just from transitioning from Black Hispanic to a white, predominantly white school. And it was pretty influential.
Yeah. And that's very similar to my experience at Olivet. You know, you walk on this campus, you know, a young African-American kid from the inner city of Flint, and you walk onto this campus with kids whose fathers own, you know, corporations and businesses. And, you know, their lifestyle was totally different than the lifestyle in which you've been accustomed to your entire life. But I tell you, one of the positive things that it did is it really afforded us the opportunity to see how other people or would expose us to how other people had lived their lives and, you know, what was available and what the opportunity was. And, you know, I wouldn't trade my experience for anything in the world. Although, you know, at the time, the transition may have been a difficult one. There were some very valuable life lessons in that whole space and time of growing up and going from all African-American to all white. You know, you get the contrast between both sides. And certainly growing up in Flint and growing up in that African-American culture, there's a lot of things that you take with you that are valuable insights throughout life. And then having to make that transition I think it made it easier, simply because, you know, you've dealt with adversity your entire life. And now you're in this environment where you're learning, you know, something totally different and new, and having new experiences. But living through the adversity have taught you how to survive hurdles, how to survive challenges, how to, you know, how to maneuver and not get down on yourself whenever there's a hurdle or a challenge placed in front of you. So, and believe me, growing up in Flint, there's a lot of hurdles and challenges.
Do you believe that, you know, playing basketball, was that a way out, or did that help you develop some type of discipline?
It did. And, you know, basketball was really the thing that kept me from teetering over the edge, because I knew that, one, if, you know, if I didn't make the right decisions, if my grades weren't sufficient enough, then, you know, what I love to do would be taken away from me. So, you know, you had to maintain some sense of responsibility and discipline to make sure you stayed on that course.
Right.
And we're able to continue doing what you love to do. And basketball had been a part of my life since the time I was probably, you know, 2 or 3 years old enough to remember and see the joy in that game. And, you know, the joy that game brought other people. I would always watch my dad play from, you know, the time I was, you know, old enough to really understand what was going on around me. And
right.
I liked it. I loved that excitement. I loved that energy that was in the gym. You walk in the gym and there is, you know, 1,000 people or 2,000 people, whatever it may be. And to hear the fans roar, you know, it, as a young kid, you're like, hey, I want to be in that environment. And, you know, from that day forward, you know, when it really struck me, basketball has been a part of my life, even up until this day. I've been coaching now for 30 plus years. Game has given me some tremendous opportunities, and I want to give back to the game that has really, really given me a lot in life.
That's good. Yeah. And now you're in a position where your life experience plus your basketball knowledge and experience, now you can just transfer that over to the students that you're coaching. It's wonderful.
Absolutely. And it's about more than X's and O's today. Mm-hmm. X's and O's is probably about that much of it. The opportunity you have to impact the lives of young people is more valuable than the X's and O's. And that knowledge, experience, wisdom, that all translates to the X's and O's. And hopefully putting them in a position where they want to be disciplined as well to be successful.
Uh-huh. So what do you think, like, in your life growing up, what was that transition, or what was it that made you like, okay, I need to make some changes to be more intentional to make my life better?
Man, you know, the first real impactful change was deciding to leave home at 16. Mm-hmm. And if it had not have been for that decision, who knows where I would have been, man. I may have been on another path, but mm-hmm. in making the decision and moving in with my grandparents, my grandmother played a pivotal role in who I am today. And really, you know, the decision-making of a young kid that was making bad decisions at the time. Yeah. And it's all because of one thing. She believed in me. And because she believed in me, and believed in me without any restrictions. If I had continued to make bad decisions, she still would have believed that, you know, I was going to ultimately get it together. And just knowing that she believed, it got to the point where I didn't want to disappoint her because she believed in me. Right. And she ultimately became my best friend for mm-hmm. a number of years. And, you know, there was nothing I couldn't talk to my grandmother about. I mean, everything from school to basketball to sex mm-hmm. to whatever it may have been, you know, she allowed me to be me and have conversation with her. And because she did that, you know, I started to mature into an entirely different individual and accept the challenge of being close.
That's pretty remarkable. And it's so true, because your grandmother believing in you, it's like that unconditional love, right? where as parents, we always kind of have these expectations sometimes of, man, you just need to go over there and take care of business. You need to do your homework. I don't care what you got going on in your life. Look, this is what you need to do. Where the grandparents or your brother, cousins, whatever, they're like, yo, D, what's going on? It's like the communication style is different, right?
Yep. So I tell you, and there's something about being a grandparent. There's something about that life experience. There's something about that moment in time of their lives that allow them to be a little bit more comfortable than a parent.
Yeah.
We are the grandparents for the very first time of, you know, now a 2-year-old little girl that we love to death. She is our heart, our, you know, everything revolves around her right now. But we're at a different point in our lives where we've raised our kids. We were probably a lot more uptight raising our kids. And, you know, it was a brand new experience for us. You're in the middle of life. You've got your career. You got your spouse. You've got all of these pressures of first-time experiences. And you're just trying to figure it out. And as a grandparent, you know, you don't have those pressures. You're probably at the end of your career, unless you're a grandparent at 30. But, you know, we're a little bit more seasoned. Life is a little slower. We've probably seen things 4, 5, 6 times already. So when we see them, we're not uptight about them. We can go with the flow and understand that, you know, it's not the end of the world when things happen, and we can move forward a little bit more smooth.
Hey, I remember
grandparents out there that's 30, but
you know, my cousin, he was that one for me. He was like the grandparent.
He was the older brother who was wiser, even though he's my cousin. And I just never forget the times when, you know, we would just have like just real conversations where I felt like I could be myself, no matter how I was feeling. If I was mad, he would allow me to be like, hey, man, if you're mad, just say you're mad. Whereas with pops or moms, I was like, yeah. I want to say I'm mad, but if I say I'm mad, it's no telling. I might get that shoe across the face or something. You know?
What you mad that about?
That shoe or that strap. Let me give you something to be mad about.
So he gave me that. He gave me permission, right, to be myself.
And he was the one that actually encouraged me just to, hey, man, whatever it is you're going to do, do it 100%. Whatever it is you're going to do, stick with it. Don't allow anybody else to dictate what you need to do, what you should do, who to hang with. You be that person. You be that responsible person. You just make sure that they got your back in the end, and that could uplift you.
Well, just think about, you know, how many people don't have other, you know, influences in their life where they could really, you know, talk to that individual and be themselves and, you know, ask some questions about life or, you know, explore life without, you know, without it being a parent and, you know, a parent wanting to respond and interject as a parent.
Right.
It's such a valuable asset for people to have and to have people that, you know, aren't going to judge you and love you regardless of what you say or what you do.
Right.
So it was a valuable experience for me.
So as you were growing up in college or as you made that transition into your postgraduate, did you have anybody that was holding you accountable to be intentional or take action?
I was very fortunate to have some good buddies and family in my life early on. My best friend of 50 years, who just, you know, he just passed away in February, which, you know, was, you know, a pretty, you know, significant moment in my life just recently. Mm-hmm. But he was really my sounding board. He's a year older than I am. Mm-hmm. And we would hold each other accountable and we would push each other. And, you know, having him in my life and having my cousin, Aaron, who wasn't as much of an athlete, but was a student and a very bright student. He also pushed and we pushed each other. So those two people have been very influential in my life. And Aaron, you know, we don't certainly talk as much as we did when we were young. We still keep in touch with each other. He lives on the East Coast. I live on the West Coast. at one point we lived out here together. I lived in Los Angeles and I lived here, but you know, we never really talk about it, but I know we push each other. And a result of, you know, us having conversation and seeing what each other's doing in life, you know, it creates this friendly competition. Neither one of us are envious or jealous of each other, but you know, we push each other, and we've never really talked about it, but I think he would say the same thing too.
Yeah. And I think that's a whole different type of mindset when you think about, okay, I could hold my partner accountable, and all of a sudden he achieves like a certain amount of success or level of success, and you not get jealous about it. It's all about, hey, you, I just want you to be the best version of you. I just want you to continue striving and doing what you need to do. I'm going to hold you accountable. You're going to hold me accountable. We're going to push. We're going to make each other uncomfortable. We're going to stretch.
Yep. Yeah, I tell you, one of the best quotes that, you know, that I've seen over the course of my life is get comfortable being uncomfortable. Right. And if we can do that, then that means that we're pushing ourselves to grow. The only way growth comes is being uncomfortable.
And that's the reason why we decided to do this podcast, because there's too many people out there who don't want to get uncomfortable. They have these dreams, they have these ideas, but they don't have the motivation, or they believe that it's going to be too hard for them. And it's just a matter of acting and just kind of allowing things to fall. I mean, because once you start taking action, all of a sudden it attracts other people. And once people see you taking the initiative, man, all of a sudden everybody else wants to help. And that's what it's all about.
I agree. And the show that you put together, man, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's an outstanding platform, and it's a great platform. I think it's going to grab the attention of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. People have these ideas and things that they think about in their heads all the time, but they allow fear to drive them and drive them to being paralyzed and not moving forward. And the more people talk about it, the more that they see other people that have overcome that fear of being uncomfortable, that fear of the unknown, I think the greater the probability is that people are going to look at it and say, oh, I can do that too. Right. And even if they fail, you know, failure becomes a part of our growth and allows us to wipe ourselves off and keep going again.
Right. So can you share, like, I guess just the road to where you are today, just in the healthcare?
Man, we just had a town hall meeting. One of the first things that I started off my conversation with was putting people in my position as a young 21-year-old African-American coming into corporate America. And I wanted to start my conversation off that way because we had potential allies that were a part of this town hall that weren't a part of our organization. And I wanted them to have some empathy for how African-Americans felt coming into corporate America. And so when I came into corporate America, it was the result of affirmative action. At that time, corporations had to hire a certain percentage of African-Americans or minorities. And honestly, I just happened to get lucky. I was blessed. You know, God's managed to put me in some positions that I could have never imagined being in and allowed me to take advantage of opportunity. But when I came into corporate America, it was, I see in sales, there was probably 2 to 3% of the overall sales force with Pfizer. So the sales force was probably 150 people. And as I can recall, there was probably only three of us around the country. So when I started this conversation out, you're talking about being uncomfortable.
Right.
You are now in a position where you've got to simulate to this culture that is unknown to you, and there's nobody that looks like you. I was the only one on the West Coast. The other two, one was in Detroit and the other one was in Baltimore. So it's not like we're talking to each other on a daily basis and we're seeing each other in the office. We were all working, you know, from our home office at that time, covering territories. But I said to them, imagine taking a 21-year-old white kid wearing a seersucker suit and a Rolex watch and dropping him off in the inner city of Flint, Michigan. And think about how that white kid is going to feel in that environment. Well, it's the same way that an African-American kid would feel, you know, being placed in a corporate environment that I was in at that particular moment. And at the end of the day, it's all about us having empathy for each other and understanding the perspective of each other. But, you know, it was very impactful on my life going forward because it got me comfortable with being uncomfortable. You know, it's the only way you can really survive in corporate America as African American.
That is crazy.
It is. And there was about 10 or 15 years when the numbers didn't change. Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, maybe 2 or 3 years after I was hired, affirmative action went away. So they were made to hire African Americans at that time. And then that incentive went away. And you know, that growth probably declined. You know, I'd walk to some of the meetings or some of the conferences, and I'm looking, where's somebody that looked like me? And it was hard to find.
Look, there was no cell phones or text messages.
There was no cell phones. There was no texting. As a matter of fact, if you needed to make a call to Audex to check your voicemail, you had to go to a payphone and put in 20 cents to check your voicemail. So that's how far we've come in terms of technology in the last 30 years or so. Crazy.
Your story, just working in corporate America is just, I mean, it's amazing, right? Because there's so many people who believe that, you know, success just will happen if they just kind of pour their lives and work hard in their career without any kind of growth or personal growth and development. But here you have it. Here you put in a situation, being uncomfortable. That's one level of growth right there. And then having to manage people and your mindset at that time also as a young man.
Yeah. And I talk about the value of my grandmother, but my grandfather also played an important role. And one of the things that I'll never forget, and it's been a part of my life from that moment on, I had just walked across the stage from getting my undergraduate degree, and he pulled me aside and said, "Now, son, you have an opportunity. I believe education," and these are, I'm paraphrasing, but these are almost his exact words. "I believe education is a great equalizer for our community. You have an opportunity to open the doors for African Americans that look like you. You also have the responsibility to keep those doors open." Mm-hmm. And at the time, it seemed like a lot of pressure.
That's what I'm about to say.
For many years. You know, I carried that burden and felt like it was pressure. I guess it was very similar to living up to my father's name. Now I had to make sure that I didn't do anything to close the doors behind African Americans. So, I mean, I can tell you, you know, some pretty treacherous experiences of being in corporate America and calling on hospitals in these rural areas in Northern California. And honestly, you might as well be in the South, because they treated you the same way as you would be treated in the South. And you had to maintain their professionalism to work through it and make sure I didn't, you know, get outside of myself and, you know, close the doors for somebody else behind me.
What were one of your methods to handle an adversity like that? What was something that you would actually do, or would you just shrug it off and be like, you know what, I'm not going to allow this person to have control over my joy or my day?
Well, I mean, it really, those words of my grandfather, mm-hmm. I would have to call on those words many times. I would have to call on what he said to me on many occasions. I mean, I've said I'll give you one of the things that happened to me early on in my career. We sold a cavitational ultrasonic aspirator, and this aspirator would actually remove tumors, brain tumors, and leave the vascular structures in place. So it would work around the veins and areas of the brain that were high in elasticins, so that, you know, you wouldn't be impacted by actually removing the tumor itself. And I was in Clear Lake, California, and, you know, they had purchased one of these aspirators and were going to market it to the community. And so I'm sitting down with, you know, this woman in marketing, and I'm asking her questions to understand the demographics of their community. And she says, I ask her the question, so tell me a little about the community that you have here and the makeup of that community. And she says, you know, we have a lot of, you know, retirees, and, you know, people who have been here for a long time. But we also have a lot of the N-word that move up here from Oakland.
What?
Yeah, I'm 21 years old, and I'm sitting across from her, and she says this, and honestly, it took me by surprise, first of all, but she said it, and she said it in a manner just like we're talking here today, and didn't even register with her that she was saying something that was derogatory or negative, and I don't know if it was because she was looking at me and, you know, thinking that she wasn't directly talking about me per se.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had to call on the words of my grandfather. And because, you know, my first thought after I got over the shock was to, you know, be outraged and to really come back at her with some venom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and as I thought about it internally and processed it in my mind, that could have had some very impactful results if I had done that. One, I may have lost a job that, you know, people probably didn't want to give me in the first place.
Right.
I may have lost a sale, which would have been my income. And most of all, I may have impacted the opportunity for some other African-American to be in that same position. But if it hadn't have been for those words from my grandfather, I don't know if I would have been able to maintain my discipline and professionalism in an effort to move forward. Wow. So his words have kept me grounded for, you know, many instances.
Right.
That was just one. I'm telling you, I mean, it's been many throughout my career.
So what actually made you get into that field?
I had a friend named Vaughn Derry who had been in healthcare for a number of years. He's a couple years older, was doing well, making good money, you know, as a young
chasing
man.
Chasing the money, y'all. Just about chasing the money.
Chasing the money. You grow up, look, you grow up with, you know, a very small amount of money. We weren't poor, but we weren't middle class either. And when you see all these people in college that, you know, they don't even have to be there to get a degree in a certain field. They just have to get a degree because it's what their parents want them to do. They're going to walk away and have a high position in a corporation that's owned by their parents. And they're going to have a pocket full of change. They're going to live in nice homes. They're going to do all this stuff. You know, you want to have some of the things that you've been afforded the opportunity to see from your peers.
Right.
And it was a pathway. It was a pathway to get to that particular lifestyle. You probably learned, we've known each other now. We've known each other now for close to, 20 years at least. And you're probably learning some things about me that you never know. And we never had an opportunity to share these stories.
Uh-huh.
That's why we need to do it over cigars.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I don't know. These are just conversations that,
right,
you know, they don't, really come up, you know, some of these conversations about work and work experience,
right,
I haven't even shared with some of my family members. You do what you need to do to move forward and, you know, advance your position, advance your lifestyle, right, for your family, mm-hmm, and make sure that their station changes as we go along.
Yeah. When you share that incident that happened with the lady and she's just communicating with you and then all of a sudden she dropped the N word on you, it reminded me of a time when the market was really bad and we had that economic downfall in 2008. I ended up getting laid off. During that time, I go interview with some other agencies. And so I have an interview with one particular agency. And one of the questions that this lieutenant asked me, he was like, how would you feel or what would your reaction be if you had to go for a call of service and this particular area is kind of known for being a little racist? How would you handle if they called you the N-word, right? My only response at that time was like, look, it wouldn't be the first, it wouldn't be the last. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think, and just with my family, you know, growing up in Louisiana and going to certain areas where black folks just weren't allowed to go after certain times, it's just part of like who we are and like, you know, some of the things that we just have to deal with. So you just make it happen. So
I agree. But, you know, there's some people that don't have the discipline to overcome the emotion.
Right.
And that's what it is. It's really about, you know, our ability to control our emotions and not allow our emotions to take away opportunities from us.
Right.
Because those moments can really, you know, turn into some unintended consequences that really alter the course of our direction.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's look, Bruce Springsteen, that brother said, a time comes when you need to stop waiting for the man you want to become and start being the man you want to be.
Man, look, I love Bruce. One of the things about you know, having all of these cross-cultural experiences, it opens your mind up to so many different things, different experiences. And music was always one of them for me. Just being exposed to different genres of music, you know, allows you to really take a look at the value of the music itself and not what genre it's in. So Bruce has always been one of my favorites. And that quote from that song is pretty powerful. You know, early on I talked about, you know, being 10 years old. And basically, after my second divorce, you know, it really forced me to take a look at myself.
Yeah.
I was at a really dark place for the first time in my life. I mean, literally for the very first time in my life, mm-hmm, I was at a dark place because I had gone maybe 15 years between my first divorce, who I married my college sweetheart. And we divorced shortly after we got married. And, you know, I was single for 15 years, you know, living my best life. And finally, I got to a point and I'm like, okay, it's time to settle down. It's time to, you know, become an adult and stop playing. And I thought I was doing everything the way that I should have been doing them to be the husband that I should be. And ultimately it ended in divorce. And, you know, although the direct impact of the action was her action, I had to step back and for the first time in my life, ask myself some very, you know, pointed questions. Why are you selecting the women that you're selecting, or why are you making the decisions that you're making? And, you know, when you really look back on it, every decision that we make ultimately boils down to us. And it's not the other individual, it's us. And when you pull the covers back, you know, I didn't like what I was seeing in me and why I was making the decisions that I was making. and you have to really deal with, you know, you have to deal with that ugliness in the mirror, and ultimately get to the point where you can forgive yourself for being that individual and for making that decision or those decisions, and move forward.
Right.
But that was a time when, you know, I really had to take a look at me and grow up and understand why I was making the decisions I was making. And it really changed my life.
Yeah.
It was just me and God. It's just me and God.
You said so much right there. You and I, we doggone near have the identical storyline when it comes to relationships.
Yes, we do.
Like, goodness gracious.
I think we finally got it right this time.
I think so. I believe it. I believe it in my heart.
Me too. Me too. So I'm going to say that and I'm going to leave it there. And it also helps that we're a lot more mature in who we are as individuals too.
Right. Mm-hmm. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Why Not You with Mr. Cloyce Dickerson. Hey, that was only part one. Stay tuned for part two. You are definitely going to be blessed. This next episode, where he actually digs into Intentionally Yours Marriage Group. And you all have a blessed week. And remember, we cannot become what we need if we remain where we are.